statements made by the G8, particularly towards Africa, and Ambassador Machila will be taking us through the presentation. The DG communicated to me that he would have loved to be with us today, but unfortunately he's attending the meeting at the NCOP, and that he will join us next week when we consider the budget. And even on that aspect, he has indicated that members will receive a budget document.
Emails, because then that's an obvious need to rely on service officers, who are obviously very unreliable in delivery of documents. It does actually mean that preparation for the meeting is very problematic if the documents arrive just under an hour before the meeting starts. And I don't know if you could direct the committee secretariat to do something, at least to email the documents electronically, so that we can actually prepare properly for these meetings. Otherwise, obviously, the oversight question becomes a bit redundant.
Indicating that the DG has indicated the fact that the budget document is unprinted, and they will then submit a document that will not have been printed. We agreed with the DG that we will continue, for purposes of our preparation, we'll continue with the document that has not been printed, and with an understanding that there will be no changes between the document they will give us and the document that will be a printed one, and that they will then send the printed document on the 10th, 2 days before the portfolio committee sits. We have agreed that members will then receive a document. I'm raising this so that when members receive that document, they should not be worried that it's not a printed document, given the fact that they are worried that the printers might not meet the deadline. And he has indicated that the problem is that there was a misunderstanding between the department and parliament as to when should documents be submitted. And then due to that misunderstanding, they will be unable to meet the deadline that was set by parliament. We have subsequently agreed, so members will receive a black and white document with an understanding that that will allow them the time to prepare and for the meetings of the 12th. I'm advised that this document will be available today, yesterday or today, and as soon as we get the document, it will be sent to members. As to the issue of documents that relate to presentations and they have not arrived in time to members, I think it's a matter that will have to be taken up with the DG himself, because I think we've raised this thing and it continues to be that situation, DG. We agreed that documents for purposes of presentation and for allowing members to make preparations, it will be important that they arrive in time. At least by yesterday, this document was not in, because the communication from the committee secretary was that the document from the department has not arrived, and the document distributed was a document that was pulled up by Parliament Research Unit, which was sent to members by yesterday. We think that it's in the interest of members to receive the document and make preparation for the meeting in time. And therefore, it's important for the department to do that. We are raising it, and probably will raise it again with the DG, so that we ensure that we receive the documents timely in preparation for members. Honourable members, one other issue that I need to raise, or rather two, is that I received a letter from Honourable Leon in regard to the request for us to consider a discussion on Zimbabwe. I have responded to that letter. It might have arrived to Honourable Leon. We are working on that. We are hoping that if at all possible, we should get that briefing just before we adjourn. We might have to look at the days. And I'm raising this because we might have to ask members to stay one Friday for that particular meeting, because we might have to slot in that meeting outside the normal program. The second aspect relates to members have been calling the office, raising the fact that they've seen the news that the South Africa voted in a particular way in the Security Council. And they expected the chairperson to give answers to that. I indicated that I may not be able to give those answers, but subsequently I've written a letter to the minister to request a brief on that, that if you could write back to us, which is the correspondence I'll share with members, to indicate to us what were the consideration for the vote and the vote they've taken. I've done that, so I'm expecting that as soon as I get that communication, I will then be able to share it with members and answer the question that they've been asking. What were the considerations for South Africa to make certain decisions? With that, honourable members, can we then give it to the DDG?
Chair, thanks very much for once more inviting the Foreign Affairs to interact with the honourable members on the issues that we are engaging on a daily basis. And all members and the chair, may I first apologize for receiving the document late. We hope to improve on this system so the honourable members are able to prepare for the meeting. Chair, we have been asked today to come and brief the honourable members on the issue of G8, because honourable members, I'm sure, are aware that there is a summit coming in Hokkaido, Japan, in July. I would like to share with the honourable members about first the background, the evolution of the G8, and how we have been engaging with the G8, and perhaps take the honourable members on some of the content of the previous G8 decisions, and then begin to map out how do we move to Hokkaido, and the kind of interaction processes that we'll be taking in Hokkaido, and our position in Hokkaido. Honourable members, just a bit of background. The G8 started as an informal grouping of eight countries. First, there were six of them. It was France, Japan, Germany, Italy, UK, and USA. And these six countries looked into global issues at that time, around 1975. But in 1976, Canada joined the grouping. And because of the global issues around 1990, 1991, 1992, there was a need to increase dialogue between these countries and Russia in the post-Cold War era. And therefore, Russia was invited first for breakfast, then for lunch, then for dinner. It became sort of a permanent dialogue. We are still at the breakfast level, so Russia is now part of the system. The primary concern was the global economic issues affecting industrialized countries at that time. But increasingly with globalization, they saw a number of interdependence issues and therefore began to also focus on political issues issue of peace and security, climate change, and then there is the issue of Africa, especially with the formation of NEPA. So these issues started to occupy the G8. And then the men said, once we're done with Africa, then let's move into the outreach program. Let's have interactive sessions with African leaders every time we meet on the issue of Africa, peace and security, now that they have their own program, the African program. The evolution of G8 from economic issues has now created a possibility where they deal with issues globally. Now, our engagement with the G8 was based on the political mandate of the cabinet, Lokota, to look on the North-South dialogue. It's very, very important to ensure that there's this continuous dialogue with the North, and then begin to use that engagement to deal with the issue of African agenda. And so, since Karnatsky talked Okinawa until now, there is a continuous dialogue with the G8 on African issues. And then, with the African issues being part of the permanent agenda of the G8, they then look into these emerging economies, China, South Africa, India, Brazil, Mexico. And then they say, let's form what is called the G5 outreach, because these countries have some form of influence on the global systems of governance, both economic and political. So then China, South Africa, India, Brazil, and Mexico became part of this G5 outreach programs since that time. Now, the issues of Africa started, in fact, in 1988 in Birmingham, when the G8 looked into the question of heavily indebted countries, the debt overhang of the hippie countries. And there was a determination at that time that with this huge debt overhang, Africa may not have the possibility to go and sustain development. And therefore, they look into issues of how to provide relief for the crowd countries. Then in 1999, in Cologne, they launched what is called the IPIC Initiative. Then in Okinawa, in 2000, summit, it was the first time when the G8 invited African leaders to that outreach program. And South Africa has been part of that from the very, very onset, from Okinawa. And I don't remember if you will recall that there was a time when the Japanese launched this multi-billion ICT program. But it was the outcome of Okinawa that the Global Fund for HIV, AIDS, TB, and Malaria was launched. It was sort of that sort of debate. Then in Genoa, in 2001, the G8 for the first time looked very closely on NEPAD, a NEPAD program. With the background of Okinawa, then they look at the NEPAD program on infrastructure development, peace and security, agriculture, education. And then they say maybe the G8 need to have some determination. It was because of this Okinawa-Genoa process that in 2002, at Karnatsky, they launched the African Action Plan. Now, the African Action Plan concretized the commitment from Birmingham to Cologne to Okinawa to Genoa. It is some form of comprehensive document to engage Africa with the G8. And the core of that document was to address the MDGs, the Millennium Development Goals. Then in 2003 in Avianz, the G8 looked more closely on issues that can again reinforce the African Partnership Forum dialogue. And in 2004 in Sea Island, they focused President Bush refocused the G8 on the issue of HIV/AIDS and polio. And we recall that it was in that meeting that Americans launched this huge program for Africa. I was just taking this sort of background to show the evolution of African engagement with the G8. As I say, to us, Kananaskis was a turning point because Kananaskis developed the African Action Plan and undertaking to support NEPA. And after this discussion in Kananaskis, the OECD determined that it cannot only be the G8 responsibility or obligation to assist Africa. The entire OECD countries need to come to the party. And so they established this African Partnership Forum, that is OECD plus Africa. Regrettably, this has not taken shape and it's not really, really effective. But as a platform, we thought it was a very important development. I think the major thrust came at the meeting when the present Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, then the Chancellor, took the issue of Africa even more broad and deeper. Honorable Brown then developed what we all know as the Africa Action Plan, targeting various issues that need to be done and focusing on the ODA commitment made in Monterrey to support the G8. I mean the outcomes of the Millennium Development Goals. And the outcome of that legal agreement was that all these countries, especially the G8, will double the ODA by 2010. We still have to see this commitment. So far, we are only aware that the Canadians are working very hard on that, but I think the rest of the G8 countries have a bit of a problem. Now, we just wanted to summarize the outreach program, the Vinegar Agreement, because we thought this was a major development. They committed to double the ODA by 2010 to 50 billion. We are still holding them to this commitment. They decided to write off debt of about 40 billion for the African countries. Our last count was around 1920 have benefited. So they developed some system through which if the countries qualify, especially those hippie countries qualify, instead of paying debt, the funds could be used for social development, education, health, etc., etc. So far we are aware that countries have benefited. Ghana was the first country, and so numerous countries in sub-Saharan Africa have benefited from this program. Not all of them have written off debt from developing countries. But we do see a very progressive movement toward debt forgiveness from developing countries. Of course, there are a bit of conditionalities that have to be met, among them governance questions, question of corruption, question of accountability, and focus on the social programs. But we do see very, very positive development in this area. And the other issue that commitment was to eliminate export subsidies. I think at that time it was hoped that the Doha Development Agenda shall have moved progressively from Hong Kong in 2006 and shall have concluded in 2007. But unfortunately, we all know that the Doha round is still on intensive care. When they go out of intensive, we don't know. So they have not. I don't think they can realize this objective. Here. But I think we still hold them, politically still hold them accountable to this commitment to eliminate export subsidies. After all, this is our core demand on the Doha Development Round. And then there was the issue of universal access of HIV/AIDS treatment by 2010. This was supposed to have been followed with the necessary funding mechanism and program, research, more and more training of people to monitor the dispensing of necessary medicine for them. So it's still a commitment that we believe that the G8 is committed to, and we think that we need to assist them to realize this goal. And the major one, again, from the needle was the full funding to the eradicate polio. I think, by and large, this is on track, that it is possible to eliminate polio funding, disease through funding. The challenges, so those were the commitments, those were the sort of political commitments by the GA. However, in the implementation, we begin to see a bit of difficulty here and there. The first one is for them to agree that we should continuously review commitment made. And we can just add commitment to commitment. We say, let's review Kananaski because it was far reaching. Let's review Jeningel because it was far reaching. So that is still a bit of a problem. The second one is how to integrate NIPAS into the GE programs. Because they've been saying, Africa has its own development program, which are now regionally coordinated. Is it possible that all these commitments, these infrastructure and others, can be dovetailed into the NIPAS program? We still have to discuss this issue. We have been discussing with this issue in Japan as late as a few months back to say, let's drift towards the NIPAS program. The other issue is the institutional setup of this African Partnership Forum with the OECD. Because by and large in this meeting, you see a heavy influence of the OECD. I think particularly so, because first of all, they are more established. Secondly, there's a predictable system in their part. But thirdly, because they are the ones who come to the party financially. But we still have to set this mechanism that we believe will enhance the partnership. With this background, we then said Hokkaido needs to be slightly different. Hokkaido should be different from the past one. We had a very good meeting in Germany last year. We had a very good meeting in the U.S., in Canada, all over. But we have not seen concretely how this commitment translates in the visible programs in the continent. We do begin to see the impact from the Global Health Fund. We did see individual commitment like the U.S. HIV/AIDS programs. But collectively, we like to see a more robust response to the challenges of Africa. And it is for this reason that we thought the African Partnership Forum, the 10th one, should really look into how we boost economic growth and reduction of poverty. That if we can focus in this area on the sustained economic growth in the continent, which we believe will then help us to deal with the issue of poverty. But to do that, we have programs. We show them programs on infrastructure in NIPAS, corridors, Southern Africa, linking up sub-regional organizations, energy programs, telecommunication programs, infrastructure programs on various fields. So we said if we can deal with these basic infrastructure programs, and then we deal with the question of ICT, question of agriculture. There is a very clear program from the AU on what to deal with agriculture in NIPAS. And then gender mainstreaming. We're saying to the G8, if you can really deal with that.
Just a point of information. Which document are we speaking of?
It is a slide on average towards Hokkaido.
I've got only one sheet.
Apologies, ma'am. Apologies.
The G8 one. Is that the one?
Yes. On the under the outreach towards okay. Is that a number okay?
Yeah,
okay. So that is the first challenge of dealing with them. The second one was on this African Action Plan. It should be a two-way process where we are accountable in the continent to whatever programs suggested.
But we must have core responsibility dealing with these issues. And the issue of climate change, this is going to dominate the G8 summit in Hokkaido, like it did in Germany, the issue of climate change. How does Africa respond to the climate change question, to commitment to climate change? Honourable members, you are aware of the outcome of the Bali conference in December on the climate change and the commitment that the developing countries are supposed to shoulder as a consequence of this. So it is those commitments vis-à-vis economic development challenges and how we balance these two, our commitment to climate change, the impact of commitment into our development program. So this is an issue that needs to be discussed with the G8 in Tokyo. I think it's on the 7th of July. There's the G8 plus Africa program. So these issues, I think, will be discussed there. I did refer to German summit of the G8 because we thought something very important came out of that summit. And this was the high-level political dialogue that took place in Germany. But it didn't only stop into this high political dialogue. There was a commitment towards investment, energy, and development with a very special focus on Africa. And hence we thought if we can build in 2008, if we can build in on the Helen Gadden outcome, we may take the African agenda a step forward. And then the other issue is the interim report in Hokkaido that, arising from this German commitment that we believe that it does not only contain the agreement, but it will begin to outline in more concrete items on what is it that the G8 wants to do for Africa. And hopefully that the summit in Italy will give even further impetus to this developmental agenda. And then the OECD, we have been discussing how best to utilize this platform because we have all these developing countries in this platform, not only the G8, to support the African Partnership Forum and support the unit that is dealing with these issues. But I remember you are aware that we are actually in the development pillar. We are co-chairing with France, the development pillar of this African Support Partnership Forum. We have a regular dialogue with France on these issues. And likely France is very, very sensitive on, more sensitive, I think, on the African issues. So we believe that we can make a bit of movement during our co-chairmanship of this important part. The summit is taking place in Hokkaido from the 7th to the 9th of July. The broad issues in this agenda will be the permanent agenda question of the macroeconomic issues. Prior to this meeting, ministers from different countries are meeting. We have ministers of energy, we have ministers of environment, minister of infrastructure. They are meeting in Japan, I think, July, April, very active month in these processes. And it is believed that all these important meetings, including the finance minister of the G8, just on the eve of the summit, will culminate on the robust discussion on macroeconomic issues on the summit. With the present economic climate, global economic climate, and with the U.S. economic problems, we have to understand that this issue will dominate. Climate change, honourable members know that Japan is very upbeat on the issue of climate change, the Kyoto Protocol, especially after Australia, in Bali, Australia acceded to the Kyoto Protocol and leaving the U.S. alone out of this system. So there is a bit of impetus on the issue of the climate change. And then the African agenda question, the MDGs, this is the African agenda question. Health, on the health issue, the question will be how to provide support
to research in tropical diseases and medicine. So this will be the issues that they will be looking at in Hokkaido. And support for national health systems and reproductive health to be integrated into the G8 program. So there will be debate around the health question. On education, the major issues to be covered there will be support for science and technology development in Africa. So that will be one of the issues that the G8 will be looking at. And to provide support for exchange of scholars and the fees increasing of financial assistance to primary, secondary, tertiary and vocational training. So this will be some of the issues that will be covered under the African agenda issues. So most of them will come out of the ticket for summit. Another must remember that Japan and Africa started dialogue in 1993 when the Japanese government invited African leaders to Tokyo to launch what is called Tokyo International Conference on African Development, TICAD. So that's TICAD 1. Part of that was the Japanese realization of how marginalized Africa is. So Japan wanted to create a platform where the world could begin to address African issues in the post-Cold War era. And TICAD became a very, very useful platform to raise the profile and actually African issues. So today we had three TICAD summits. This will be the fourth TICAD summit. The outcome of this TICAD summit from the 27th to the 30th of May will be worked into the G8 summit in July. On political issues, because it's Japan, so Japan looking to the neighborhood, and it's going to be the issue of North Korea, Afghanistan, Iran, a nuclear issue, the issue of counterterrorism and peace building, and Sudan. So these will be the issues that will be discussed as a part of political agenda. In terms of just the process, the summit will start with Africa on the 7th. Of July, on the issues that are raised, issue of education, health, water, and other various issues. So the G8 will be sitting with African countries to review all the past agreements and see how these are translated into programs. Then on the 8th of July, the closed session is the G8 itself, and on July 9 is the usual meeting of the G8 plus the G5, India, South Africa, Brazil, China, and Mexico. So now, Japan brought its neighbors, Australia, Indonesia, and South Korea. Of course, there are necessary preparations need to be made. Like, as I said earlier on, there are a series of ministerial meetings that will be organized by Japan until we have the summit itself. On our side, on the third week of March, the ministers are meeting in Gabon. Foreign ministers are meeting in Gabon to look into the potential plan of action of TICAD and the declaration of the summit itself that will then go into the issues. I have indicated to members that there are a bit of dynamics we are dealing with. I don't know if you recall that we hosted the IPSA summit, India Brazil South Africa summit, October 17 last year in South Africa. And in this summit, President Begi, President Lula, and Prime Minister Singh of India reviewed their participation in the G8 program as part of the G5. And I remember recall that they did say that it's not only nice to go for breakfast. You are being called to come for breakfast. You cannot travel all over the world to go for breakfast meetings. which means is that they need meaningful participation, including agenda setting, and take part in the outcome, not just to respond on what the leaders have decided. So this is a big challenge for us on how do we develop agendas of participation for this. The second part of this was to narrow the agenda. In Germany, in UK, and in USA, the subject discussed with the G8 was wider, and Russia, it was wider. But it has been narrowed to climate change. So the leaders are saying, but what about the issue of energy that we discussed in Russia and Germany? What is the question of economic development that we discussed in Germany? Why only climate change? So it has been narrowed now to climate change. What is the marginalization of any media and them process? That we should go back at least. We should not go below what we agreed in any gender. So I think that is part of the challenge. And then the other issue that has been raised by President Sarkozy, Prime Minister Brown, was, but why is this G5? Why don't we just have G13? Why do we keep on bringing them breakfast, sometimes lunch? Why don't we just institutionalize this G13? Because these are countries with influence, Mexico, China, India, Brazil, South Africa. So let's stop this process of half arrangements. Let's just have them once and for all as part of the GA. So there is a dynamic, there is a bit of debate there, where a increasing number says maybe it makes sense to include these five into the permanent arrangement for that. So we don't know when this will be discussed formally. We hope that at one stage they should be discussed. But let me say, maybe it's not the form for us, what is very important. It's not the form. Really, the content. It's engagement content. Not the form. It's a content. And to be seen, to be listened to. And of course, our views being respected. But we think it's a very, very important development when some members begin to see the important role played by some of these countries from developing countries. So we thought that what is South Africa's position? What should we do as South Africa in this forum? We should use this forum to consistently influence the thinking on development. Because indeed it was the members of NIPAT, the Karanaskis, that begin to capture the G8 and say maybe there is something in the continent. So we believe that we should consider this issue. We should begin to continue to focus Africa, the G8 on African issues to support African agenda. And also to remind them that we need equitable global economic system. We should promote mutual understanding and act as development partners in real sense. The issue that we have is, are we partners? If we are partners, are we equal? And I think that's where the dilemma is. But we hope, honorable members, that if the Japanese government can work with us closely on the ticket processes, including the summit in Japan of African leaders and Japanese, if that succeeds, we have a better chance to influence the potential outcome of the G8 when they interact with Africa on the 7th of July. Chair, I don't know whether I was very helpful in answering the issues that the honourable members wanted us to address. I want to thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Kwini Chair. We will be able to only to answer that when members indicate in their questions whether have you been able to answer that question. Honourable members, now your chance to engage the DDG. Honourable Leon, Fats Banda, Madasa, and Honourable Mewa.
Mr. Chairman, to you, to the Ambassador, well, first of all, thank you very much. I thought it was a very informative briefing. I'd like the Ambassador to really address two, and they're related questions. in your briefing you referred to the core function, foundational function of the G8 was to deal with global economic issues affecting industrialized nations. Now, given the context of the world economy, subprime crisis, the liquidity crisis on global markets, to what extent do you think that is going to crowd out or dominate other issues which we would like to advance there? And yeah, if you could address that in a companion question. Given that the United States is, of the G8 nations, economically the most significant, presumably there's a problem with Hokkaido, because in 6 months after Hokkaido, the administration of the United States is going to change. And I've noticed with some concern that in the very intensely fought Ohio primary campaign which ended last night, that both Democratic contenders, Senator Clinton, who won, and Senator Obama, who just lost, were extremely protectionist in their view. And I relate this to your point about Doha. And in fact, Senator Clinton went so far as to say, as I recall, well, it's time for America to take time out from multilateral trade agreements. Now, I mention that because, and I mean, it might be that the Democrats don't prevail in this election, but even if there are commitments made at Hokkaido in respect of eliminating export subsidies, if there's a change, or there will be a change in administration, whoever wins, the United States, what is the likelihood of any commitments made in Hokkaido being binding on economically the most significant ones, the G8 nations?
Thank you, Chairperson.
Chairperson, I think I'll try to minimize my question. I'll have only four questions. But first question, DDG, about the issue of climate change. I understand from your input that there is a conference towards the 12th of December. Okay. I wanted to find out that if in the party government there is any means, maybe to assist people to avoid the situation whereby other countries, in particular the developed countries, who will take an advantage to exploit people, like the incident which took place sometime during the apartheid era, whereby there was a drought in one of the former homelands. They were advised to buy a machine which will make a rain to fall. Of which that thing never worked. People were able to reap money, huge money. And then secondly, DTG, in terms of there was a comprehensive commitment by the G8 towards Africa in the summit which took place in UK 2005 in Cleveland. In that summit, they took a commitment about on peace and security. Now, my worry, DDG, is that most of the countries in the African continent has requested help from the developed countries in the form of aid as well as contribution of the debt which are supposed to be refunded to the developed countries. But now, I don't understand exactly that commitment, the response, maybe in particular from the different countries, which is from, from the USA, the issue of AFRICOM. Does it the same commitment or not? Because there was a commitment of the standby security force. But now the response is one country which wants to impose on us. And then second question is about the summit in Germany in 1999, where in Cologne, whereby they've launched the HIPS, highly indebted poor countries initiative. So I wanted you to find out from maybe the DDG that there's any development. They are scraping those debts, or the debts are still there. Because my understanding is that there were some countries who were willing to assist
to, in particular in Africa, but there were countries who were not able to address it. And then lastly, I wanted to find out DTG that in terms of this new proposal of the G5, which includes us and which includes South Africa, India, Mexico, and China and Brazil, I wanted to find out that is any means or any development to include us in G8 in terms of implying agendas, setting participation in the summit, influencing the outcome. Because normally what is happening, we can come up with a lot of ideas, good ideas, but at the end, some people they thought or they think that you'll use us as an instrumental of imperialism. Thank you.
Okay, we'll come back to you to the other hands. The DDG wants to deal with these questions that have been asked. But I just want to say to members that we might have to contend with the noise. I've been trying to see whether we can have a slowdown on it. We are told that somebody has given a firm instruction that they must not even consider anything that we say. They must just continue and pretend that we don't exist. I'm desperately trying to find out where the instruction comes from. All what I could gather now is that it's a firm instruction, and they comply with the instruction. Because it has implication. I don't understand why Parliament will book this venue if they know that there's this noise. And I'm asking members to contend with that in the meantime.
Thanks, Chair. Chair, the issues raised by Honourable Dion, I think Honourable Member has as an issue that really preoccupies all of us. The issue of focusing on macroeconomic issues as a core reason of the G8. This is the core region of the G8 foundation. I think you have correctly sketched the recent uncertainties and concern on global economic trends, and including the issues that honourable members talked about, that have seen a bit of shaky tremor around the globe vis-a-vis the downturn or what people believe are elements of recession. We are not totally uninfluenced by this development. We are worried about this issue. That's why the President has written the letters to his colleagues in Mexico and in China and say we and India and Brazil decided that we need to refocus on this issue. We are aware of the uncertainties in global, in economic terms, financial issues worldwide, but we cannot only focus on those issues when the rest of us have these problems. But I have no doubt, Honorable Tony, that this is going to dominate the G8. It's going to dominate. I saw the outcome of the finance ministers in the meeting again in early April in Japan, finance of the G8. I'm very certain that there will be no better upturn on economic wise to lower the appetite on this agenda item. I think we'll see it. However, there has been an understanding that maybe this needs to be discussed with the outreach because of China and India influence, economic development in China and India, which seems to be possibly can have to absorb the potential negative impact globally. There is a suggestion that the growth of Indian economy and Chinese economy might avert recession globally. So this issue might be brought to late. We have lowered our appetite, Honorable Leon, in terms of what we can achieve in the election nearing year in the U.S. I said earlier on that I don't think we can take Doha out of intensive care. And I don't think it would be advisable for all of us to talk loudly on this issue, because there will be no listeners in the U.S. They are focusing on the election time, and you all know that during this time, the best we can do is to keep the agenda issue so it doesn't fall out. But we don't foresee any dividends, any breakthrough during the election time in the U.S. The issue of export subsidies. The U.S. has been saying that they want to move. If the EU moves, he will say we have moved, but we have not moved. Who has moved and who has not moved? The U.S. says we will keep AGOA so that Africa doesn't get disadvantaged. So keep AGOA, and indeed they have kept AGOA. The Bush administration has kept AGOA for us. The African Growth and Opportunity Act. So we're still benefiting from that process. But then they came back to us and said, let's together sit with the EU. These are the biggest subsidizers. At some stage, they were ready to reduce their export subsidies, provided that they see opening on the non-agricultural market access issues, normal issues. If you can open up Africa, because most of this is in Africa, if you move in this way, we can look into this non-agricultural market access question on NAMA issues. If the countries like India, South Africa, Brazil, Israel, we can open up, if you open up a bit, then we can open up this way. But it's a very, very difficult conditionality to reduce the subsidies. Because honestly, no one will remember that we said in our summary, the Tokyo Round of Development, Uruguay Round of Development, WTO Round, have benefited the developed countries. We thought this was time for developing countries. That's what's called DDA, Doha Development Agenda, basically to focus on developing countries. So, what do you expect during the election in the U.S.? Protectionism? Nobody will talk otherwise in the U.S. Otherwise, they won't go to the White House. We just hope that in the post-election in the U.S., we'll begin to hear different voices, different noises, more towards opening, more towards constructing equitable trading system globally, including on the issue of agriculture. And on the climate change question, I'm not sure, I don't remember how far we can go. But what we have tried to do is to make sure that our people can really understand the impact of climate change. We will politically argue for asymmetric responsibilities, differentiated. We agree that we must all take responsibilities in terms of climate change. But commitment should be differentiated and asymmetrical. Honourable members, we are among the 20 most polluters in South Africa. They differ with climate change. We accept them. But we say the response and obligations should be different because of economic what you call. I think what is left, I want to remember on the question you raised about defeating our people so that people don't take a quick buck. I think the responsibility will be that we should go and reach our people and explain to them the climate change, impact of climate change of our economies and our life. Already maybe they can see floods here and there, but I think we need more and more education on our people. You raised a very important question on the G8 commitment in the region on peace and security. Honourable members will know that part of the outcome of that Kenigil agreement, as honourable members have been calling, was to help us to create a 25,000 strong standby force so that we can quickly respond to challenges in the continent. Now, remember, you know, what has happened afterwards was EU took initiative to create what is called Peace Facility Fund. Peace Facility Fund says that if there is a problem, like we had in Burundi, there is a fund that we can access to respond, because the major problem in Africa is the resources, the abilities to respond to peace and security. There is a political commitment. We have troops, the political will, but we lack resources, financing, including capabilities to respond to peace challenges in the continent. So the EU set this fund, and not only people will recall, this fund was set from the EDF, European Development Fund, from the Sub-Saharan African countries and ACP. They took 1.5% of each ACP envelope and put it in this fund, and they doubled it with their money from their own fund and created a peace facility fund. We have been asking this fund to respond to peace movement. But we have not seen the collective G8 response. What we saw is individual members funding certain programs. The U.S. put certain programs, France certain programs, Japan, Canada, but we have not seen a collective fund to establish this standby force. Then on our own, we had regional standby forces, like we have launched in Southern SADC, our own standby force, their brigade. But we have been getting financing assistance from the EU and others on this standby force. Perhaps it was, seemed to be something like that, that, okay, do it regionally, then we support you. And we hope that we can do that. AFRICOM is a big challenge. I don't remember, you know, part of President Bush swing around the continent, 2 weeks back, Tanzania, Liberia, Benin, was part of this African standby force. But we know that the AU summit in January, they decided that it might not be appropriate to have a standby force or what we call AFRICOM facility in the continent. But it seems that Liberia, will be willing to host the AFRICOM. But I think the U.S. have explained more and more the intention of AFRICOM as a facility to assist peace in the continent, not as a facility for intervention in the African continent. The debate is still going on about AFRICOM, but I think inside it, we took a decision that we are not going to have AFRICOM in our show. Cologne 1999 and GPIC. The debate are shifting. The debate are now on assisting countries to comply on GPIC. I saw what happened in other countries, like Ethiopia and others. You need to have so many consultants to help you to deal with this issue. It's a very heavily documentative process. But as I said, so far, over 19 countries have benefited, have complied with the basic requirements, governance questions, question of human rights, question of corruption, question of clear programs of how this debt forgiveness funds will be diverted towards education and health and basic infrastructure. So we have seen quite a number of African countries have really done so much to comply, but it's still a very, very difficult process. So the 40 billion forgiveness we thought would be done by now, I don't think we've even reached half of it, but we can see this progression towards that movement of debt forgiveness. What we are trying to look at is the impact of the post debt forgiveness, whether indeed diverting money or servicing debt and putting that money into social programs have shown dividends. Because debt forgiveness was supposed to be, instead of servicing debt and paying capital, we forego it, but in your budget process, take those funds and divert them into social programs. I think we still have to see how he picks. But I think as a political commitment, we can only continue encouraging them bilaterally, multilaterally, to deal with this issue of debt. We are going to bring back this issue of debt forgiveness in the Hokkaido meeting when we have the Africa on the 7th, when the G8 meet Africa. We are going to bring back this issue of debt forgiveness. Now, the issue of the G-Agri 5, China, Brazil, Mexico, South Africa, India, and ourselves. I was saying, I want to remember that this is a very difficult dynamic because we've been in about 3-4 meetings, and it seems the experience has not been the best one in terms of inclusiveness and participation in the outcome. Honourable members know that the G8 will normally have a document agreed a month before the meeting starts. And 2 weeks before, this document is adopted as an outcome of the meeting which has not taken place. Now, you're invited to a meeting where there's already been an agreement. So our leader says, no, we have to be part of that agreement. Now, they have representatives who are part of this process. These shepherds, they call them shepherds. Each country will have one shepherd. Mexico is now coordinating us, so this shepherd will interact with our agenda. I think we have never had a much influence on the agenda. We are just being adding or responding to agenda set by the G8. So the loud cry is, please involve us in setting the agenda. Please involve us in discussing the outcome, so that there is co-ownership of the outcome of this debate. I think that is where the challenge is. And hence the discussion between President Beji and his four colleagues to say, let's talk with Japan collectively to make sure that Hokkaido summit will be very different, will be part of the very meaningful. Because otherwise, how do you fly from South Africa and fly something like 18,000 kilometers into the north part of Japan for 2 hours of something that's been concluded already? So I think that is where the debate is. I was saying, can you imagine, I'm going to be traveling around the world from Brasilia to Japan. The other end of the world is about, I think, 18 hours time different, time zone different, if not 20 hours. Then go for 2 hours and go back to Brazil. So I think there is going to be a very bit of discussion around this. We just hope that there will be a positive response and the academic. We proceed as bureaucrats. We are proceeding from the fact that they will agree to meaningful participation. So we are engaging our Japanese counterparts on the actual outcomes of this process. We had a meeting, regional meeting in Zambia with the Japanese who are going to go in 2 weeks' time to Gabon. So we are engaging them with the hope that our input will be accepted. Thanks a lot on this.
Understand in terms of this process, the decisions of the G8, are they binding on the government of the leaders who are taking this decision? What is the state of this? Because I'm raising that as a probable answer to non-implementation sometimes. I didn't hear that coming out from input. Second question I would like to raise is, in this transformation we want, do we want membership or ability to influence the agenda? I'm asking that because if you want membership, then the chances of success are higher. And actually, even the body itself may become less useful because those countries may feel that they no longer have the leverage over And on the agenda itself, following up on the question that was earlier on the trade issue, I think another complicating issue other than that was raised earlier on about the U.S. is the absence of a trade authority. There's no trade authority in the U.S. when the president is in his last term. So, essentially, they cannot participate, which then means that issues around trade have to be deferred. Those are the questions.
Honorable Mayor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Ambassador Chila, thank you for the brilliant presentation that you have made. And I want to call it brilliant for Tyler having making a journey there. But I think we need to take into account that the journey we have traveled already under the leadership of South Africa is both remarkable and salutary. With due humility, I think without South Africa, the process for the G5 to go towards what I call not only the African agenda but global coexistence would not have been possible. And I think we as South Africans salute that position of our country. But having said that, in order for us to go towards this global coexistence, it cannot be done by government and government alone, within government. You have indicated that we, for the first five, people participation. And therefore, I'd like to insist, given the nature of the world at the moment, that NGOs, people's organizations, professional bodies, all appropriate these programs as their own. And the reason why I'm saying this is because of the diversity and competitiveness of different nations and countries on the one hand, and the geopolitical maneuvering on the common G8, by the common G8 countries on the other hand. I don't expect, and I'm sure the department does not expect, that we are all angels and that these people are just falling from God's lap. That competitiveness will still be there. And the geopolitical maneuvering for various reasons will continue as far as I'm concerned. Especially because, as you do know, then we have indicated that there are independent and separate interventions by the G8 countries, especially in Africa. Now, I do not want to be obsessed only with the African agenda, as you said, and talking of global coexistence, because this is an effort which affects all people all over the world. Having made these points, what I need to know, do we have in Africa a mechanism, or shouldn't we in Africa have a mechanism to strengthen the existing monitoring system of debt forgiven, what you call a debt forgiven money? I do appreciate some efforts being made or efforts being made to direct or redirect these sums of money into social programs like irrigation. But don't you think we as a department should take the other initiative, another initiative, to make it a part of the African Union's responsibility to monitor these programs? Now, since Gleneagles, you are saying that almost 50% of the debts have been forgiven. Is there any reason why the other 50% has not been forgiven? My last question. Yes, G5 is effective, but is there a potential to over and leave separately? And if the potential is there, what are the logical consequences in the region?
Thank you.
The issues raised by honourable members are very, very interesting and thought-provoking. The question of whether decisions of G8 are binding on members or not. Honourable members, to be honest, I'm not sure whether these issues will bind the American Congress, whether when they agree on the particular issue of climate change, or agree on issues of inflation, whether American Congress will say yes or agree automatically. I think these are platforms to sensitize one another and try to work towards a particular common ground, realizing that whatever happens elsewhere will impact on the others. I think it's a platform to try to get common ground on managing the global economy in the main and take co-responsibility on the issues. Honorable, you recall whenever the finance and the governor of the Reserve Bank meet, they look into the issue of inflation, they by and large monetary systems, and then they make determination on how we can move deflation, hyperinflation, or get things saved. But I've not seen this translated into particular legislative agreements in the member states. But I think they had some form of camaraderie type or solidarity type or common understanding. But I must still indicate it's still dominated by the U.S. as the biggest economy, the biggest market. So more or less you listen to what Ban Ki-moon will say or Greenspan at that time in this finance meeting. We had hoped that at least some of them could be binding, especially on issues that deal with the Afghan agenda. If they say with WODA, we'll double it by 2010, we had hoped this could be binding agreement because we'll benefit, but it hasn't. It hasn't. When they say we'll increase almost to 0.1% of our GDP to ODA, we had hoped this will materialize. Because you can imagine how many billions will come out of this trillion-dollar budget of the U.S. in developing countries. It has not materialized. It's still at 0.09 something. So we have not seen the actual commitment being translated into certain, can you say, government agreements. The issue of whether you win membership or influence, this issue came with President Sarkozy. Our approach has been, we want to be partners. You say we are partners. You said you want partnership for development, partnership for peace. We want to be partners. If you invite us, we will not say no. Will come. But once you invite us, give us space to participate together so that the outcome can be owned by all of us, especially we the recipient. We can feel that this is not imposed, but we can feel a part of the development of the solution. Then we can sell it to our own member states and to the continent, or to our continent. But since Sarkozy says no, in 2025, China will be the big economy. 2040, China will be like the U.S. economy. India, 2050, will be bigger than German economy. So why do we leave these two guys behind? Because in 2 years' time, in our lifetime, they will be in the club. Whether we put them in G8 or not, the reality is that they will have the same economic development, if not more. So first, what was at the same time? And future. So why do you postpone to the future? Cannot do it now. Do it now because it's very clear the development that these are our the economic standard is going to move towards that around the Himalaya. That side of the Himalaya, this side of the Himalaya. Go to that side is China, this side is India. So that's where the economy is going to be. So bring them now, not later, so that
they can understand how we work. Otherwise, they will come on their own agenda and terms, and then will be forced to respond. So it's a bit preemptive. Then the Prime Minister Brown joined him. He said, it's very obvious. The horizons are clear. The future is very clear. 15, 20 years' time, they will not be noisy. They will be inside. Whether you have opened the door or not, but they will be inside. So let's open the door now. So then they gave rise to, okay, but it's very clear also that in the continent, you cannot leave South Africa outside. Brazil GDP now is 802 billion. It's almost 1 trillion Brazil GDP. So you cannot leave Brazil outside. Mexico GDP is also increasing. So you cannot leave these five guys outside. If the focus or the reason it's hard for G8 is macroeconomic issues, you can't leave these people outside. So, but we continue to say, honourable member, it is not the form. It is the content of the discussion. But I don't think honourable member will say no if you are come to G13. I don't think we say no. I think the honourable member in the parliament will ask the government to join if you are invited to the G8, to come to G13. On the trade issues, I don't know, you are right. As I said, it's the election time in the U.S. So what you do is just lower your appetite and your ambition to engage meaningfully. Lower it, keep the agenda, issue on the agenda. Don't spend more time lobbying. Just keep it there and hope and gear yourself for the post. We're even saying to Pascal Lani, just leave Doha where it is. Intensive care, just keep the temperature, not too cold, but just keep it there. And then we can then see after the inauguration in the U.S., maybe we can then take it to an honorary ward, and from honorary ward perhaps was discharged. Then we can go on with that round. So I don't think, honorable member, it would be very useful to engage in this debate. You know, the U.S. will look very inward, and that's it. Honorable member, thank you very much for your overview of South African participation. It's very heartening to see members really also appreciate the contribution that South Africa is making on global discourse. Because it is very true, Honorable Mayor, that it was because of our initiative on NEPAD. It was the initiative that we had that the G8 began to have an attention towards the continent. And that's why since that time, Saragua has been to all the G8 meetings, since that time. We're the only African country that goes to all the G8 meetings, in either form, whether it's Africa or G5, we're the only country in the continent that is a regular member of this. Not only G8 summit, but all the other ministerial meetings of the G8. We are part of that. I think it's a realization by the world, first on our intellectual contribution to shaping the African agenda, but also I think on our dedication as a nation to help to assist to deal with African challenges. The issue of the NGO participation in the G8, it has been around for some time. Of course, NGO has been there, uninvited. They participated in NGOs. You see them every time G8. They go there in their thousands uninvited. They take various forms. Some are anti-globalization movements, some are trade unions, but the NGOs invite themselves to the G8 meetings. So somebody was saying, maybe we need an organized forum where they can come through the issues and come and present to us, than for us to be throwing thousands and thousands of army and police around the cordon of the G8 meetings to deal with. Maybe it's an issue that we can facilitate with the G8 itself, or whether it's not time to include the rest of the humanity in the discussions, only focus on global issues, especially when we talk about the issue of peace and security, HIV/AIDS, malaria, tuberculosis, when you talk about the issue of climate change, maybe this is due to widen up the participation in the G8. On the need to strengthen the AU mechanism, monetary mechanism of debt forgiveness, I think it's a very, very important issue that you brought, Honourable Member, that maybe as we demand forgiveness of debt collectively, we must also have collective responsibility to monitor the outcome. We should not leave it to member states only, but it should be a concern to say what has happened to the forgiveness. Can we go on raising this issue to collectively, because we can see positive impact on the lives of people, on the recipient, or where we have debt forgiveness. Maybe there's something that we need, as South Africa, need to contribute towards the AU strengthened institutional mechanism to interact with the G8 and other institutions on the issue of debt and debt forgiveness. But also because can be a good platform to use in terms of governance questions, human rights issues, to say we have seen very positive development when these things are done collectively, because we can point to something practical in terms of changing of lives of our people for better in these countries. The provocative question, Honourable Member, you raised on why not 100% debt forgiveness. Our cry, Honourable Member, is 100%. But unfortunately, we don't manage the banks or the overdrafts of these countries. We can only plea, first of all, to our own members to do maximum to comply as much as possible for debt forgiveness, because it's only we who can benefit with debt forgiveness. There's been a very interesting dynamic. You know, now remember, you have two debts. You have government debt and private sector debt. So what has happened in many countries? We have seen the shift from government debt to private sector debt. Because politically, you can mobilize for debt forgiveness. If Japan would Japan grants South Africa, we can mobilize politically. Member of Parliament can be the member of Parliament. But if we raise money from a private sector in Japan, it's very, very difficult. So in 2004, 2003, we saw the pattern of debt forgiveness. It used to be 40-60. 60% government debt, 40% private sector. But now it's coming even more and more private sector and very less than government debt. Because it's very difficult to go to the private bank and ask for debt forgiveness. In fact, I'm told in economics, the more debt you have, the more accessible you are to the bank, because they borrow you more. If you don't have no debt, they say, no, you can't make business with this person. So we see that pattern. It's very, very worrisome pattern that we see more and more private sector debt, less and less government debt. However, I think I'm sure it's a very useful thing. I don't know how much you owe our banks in South Africa, but I'm told it's a couple of billions, hundreds of billions of rands that we owe them. That's why they say our economy is doing very, very well, you know, because I think we're borrowing more and more. So, remember, I think the pressure should go on 100% government-owned debt. I'm not sure it will be prudent to pressurize companies to forgo debt. I really don't know. I will leave that to Honourable Member's chair. Thanks. Oh, the last question on G5 and IPSA. Honourable Members, you know there is a debate. President Beatty raised the issue of IPSA expansion. Honourable Members know that it was first G8 of the South. South Africa, Nigeria, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Indonesia, India, Brazil, and Mexico. It was foreseen as a counter to the G8 of the North. But let me start with the G8 of the G3. But the fact of the matter is that for the last 3-4 years, Mexico and China have joined South Africa and Brazil in dealing with the G8. And they have formed some form of system that we understand each other, including larger global issues of terrorism,
questions of climate change, energy, apart from macroeconomic issues. We are finding one another more and more. More and more you can see a closing of ranks on this issue. But when the Indian Foreign Minister came last month, he raised the issue of BRICS. Brazil, Russia, India, and China. Okay, now there is this called BRIC. Now, with South Africa support us formalizing BRIC. In other words, if Brazil and India join Russia and China, what will be our response? Then they say, what is going to happen to ISSA? Then they say, okay, if it is BRICSA, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, what is our response? We have taken what is called strategic ambiguity on this issue. Deliberately, because we buy time and digest. What will this be? Thank you, Chair.
Well, of course, sir, that will be the last question.
And thank you, question. Chairman. It's not really a question, just a comment, and I would want to hear what Your Excellency would say about it. First, I simply want to say that the way I see it, the UN Security Council, just like the G8, they have an outlook of war cabinets for the powerful nations. They're primarily looking at the international power and security, whether through economy or through political domination or simply military intervention. And therefore, that is why this reluctance. And I think that is why they don't take binding decisions also on their own members. But I think at the same time, the South-South dialogue, to me, would be an answer to that resistance. Because then it will elevate the issue of strong partnership. I mean, the ASEAN experience is a case in point, despite their internal conflict. The second point I wanted to make was, it might be a bit controversial, I don't know. There's also a tendency amongst us not to see that the domestic policy has a bearing on foreign policy, maybe direct or indirect. For instance, in the home front, this issue of Eskom and the energy electricity crisis which we have, and then you have France coming in with $16 billion. That shows that our national economic system is a bit shifting now. There's fluidity in there. And there is also instability creeping in. And I must say also the post-Polokwane events have also rendered to that perspective that there is going to be that fluidity in our national economic system. Now, that to me will also impact on the regional economic system, where we've been talking about regional economic integration and development, that is going to be affected. And therefore, the whole continental system will be affected. And therefore, our global engagement on this global economic system, that partnership also is going to be weakened by that. And therefore, I think the question of economic sovereignty from the whole of the continent will definitely suffer. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That was just a comment I wanted to make.
If you want to... Okay. Maybe it's a comment that requires MPs to deal with, because it goes to the heart. Babu Skhosana, I agree with you when you said it's quite provocative. And indeed, it is provocative, and I suspect that it's a question that we need to engage and honestly reflect on the country and say, is the democracy we build dependent on the ability of South Africans to continue to govern in a manner that advances their development? Or is democracy in this country have to be underwritten by certain events? And based on that, therefore, that indicates the fluidity of the situation, whether there is a change, and if a change happens, where does it then put the South African system of governance and economic development? I think it is an engagement. But I want to say to you, the DDG, that we are concerned about the content, but sometimes the content takes the form of, takes the shape of the form. Therefore, we as we get preoccupied with the content, we need to look at the shape of the form itself, to make sure that the content will then advance our objective. Because if the form is not what will assist the content to be able to survive, then the content will definitely be derailed. So we need to be concerned about the form itself, not only the content. And we've raised two concepts that are of interest to me. One is our cry is for 100% reduction. It's quite interesting that you put it as our cry, because that is linked to the first one. It says debt forgiveness. Biblical people will tell you that the only sinners ask forgiveness. Now, if we argue for debt cancellation, is it because we have sinned so much that we have to cry for them to forgive us? I mean, to me, the usage of those concepts creates a problem, because what it does, it puts Africa in a situation where you are perpetually on the begging vow, because you have to cry to be forgiven, for you have sinned by borrowing, and for having borrowed, you had the support of the developed countries to actually squander the money, because some of the debt are actually squandered by the dictators. That's quite interesting, DDG, that you raised those concepts. But honourable members, I'm not sure whether you have received the two reports that were presented before me. If you look at your agenda, there's the IPSA report that you're supposed to adopt and give it to Parliament, where honourable Judge Dorothy Craig Mokel, General Bantolomisa, Blanchet attended. I'm not sure whether you all have that report. And then there's a report on the African Command. I want to suggest that we defer these two reports to our next meeting, that we agree that next week when we deal with the budget, we will start 30 minutes earlier and reflect on these two reports, and then finalize them so that we can send them to Parliament. And I still want to check that we all have both copies of these two reports. One is titled Draft Report on the United States of America African Command, and the other one is the report on the IPSA, 15-17 October 2007. Do we have those copies, honorable members? Okay. So I could then ask that we defer them to next week, and we deal with these two copies speedily. DDG, as you packed, we want to ask you, I will raise the matter with the DG also, but we want to ask you to inform the department that we want to insist that we get reports in time. Because I want to suggest at some point to this committee that in an event that we did not get reports in time, we should send the official back to actually get the report in time, and then we'll consider sitting, so that could then send a message that we mean business when we request the report in time. So could I use the opportunity that you are here, that you ask that we request the report in time. that members can have time to reflect on the report and the time to prepare themselves to engage with the briefing. It's always said that the best way to deal with the briefing is when everybody did not prepare night before, because then you are sure for case that everything you're going to say is going to be said then, and none of them will have thought the issues through. And I don't think that it impacts on the quality of our oversight over the department. We want to insist. We want to insist on that. The second aspect that I will raise again with the minister and the DG, in the last meeting we took, and we asked you to raise this issue, we took a decision that we are going to insist that political accounting officers of the department should be accompanying presentations. I know that we have agreed that at the level of the DDG we may not have a problem, but I want to insist that at least we should be honored with an apology. We should be given an apology that says the minister is not available, the two deputy ministers are not available. It should not be that the president said it's business unusual. It can't be usual that we just accept it, that whether we know or we don't know, it's neither here nor there. That we should be honored with an apology to the effect that they are not available. Thank you, DDG. Members, the meeting is adjourned.